The following podcast contains explicit language.
What's good, everyone? This is the Post Bougie Podcast for the weekend of Sunday the 13th. I'm GD, Post Bougie Provider, here with the usual gaggle of misfits. Monica, writer in D.C.
Hi.
Nicole, who works in food policy in D.C.
Hello.
And Joel, who is a reporter in Atlanta.
Hey, what's up?
This week we have two topics. We are going to talk a little bit about football and brain injuries, because that's been in the news quite a bit, and Joel actually has some experience as a football player and as someone who had a concussion in high school when playing football. And the second topic is going to be James O'Keefe, he of the pimp hats and the general antipathy towards liberal institutions, taking down some muckety muck at NPR, presumably not dressed as a pimp, but you know. So the first topic is actually, again, is going to be about brain injuries and football. Have been in the news again. They've been in the news a lot over the last year or two, but they're in the news especially again because Dave Dorsen, who was an official actually at the NFL Players Association and a former NFL player, committed suicide a few weeks ago after he shot himself. And he left a note in which he said that he wanted to donate his brain to research. A lot of people assumed that this had something to do with injuries that he had sustained over the course of his playing career. And what we've been learning a lot is that the kind of cumulative effect of head injuries over the course of players' playing careers have had really, really dramatic consequences for a lot of youngish. I mean, this guy wasn't even 50, but a lot of youngish guys who have symptoms that look like Alzheimer's or dementia, or become like really depressive. I know my beloved Philadelphia Eagles had a safety named Andre Waters, who who himself committed suicide, I think, in 2006. And he was fairly young; he was 44. After he died, they did research on, or they did some testing of his brain and found that he had the brain of like a 75-year-old man or something like that. One of the things you want to do is kind of will yourself to not think about it. Like, oh, if we just don't think about it, but it's like an issue that we can't avoid at this point. Like this, the future of football. Even in the labor negotiations that are happening right now are wrapped up, or what responsibility the league has to a player's post playing life.
You know, when somebody commits suicide, it's really hard to make judgments about the reasons they do things, and I think that's one thing that I'd heard in the days surrounding his suicide. That he did it because of this, and I just don't know that that's fair, or you know, that anybody could ever really know why somebody might take their own life. And then the other thing being, you know, football is indefensible. And I think my objection comes to, it's hard to say something is indefensible when it's, you know, football, to borrow a phrase, is it's a volunteer army, basically. You know, not many people are forced to play football.
Right.
You know? And I mean, you know, and I think I mentioned there, I was like, you know, I would do it all over again. Knowing what I know now, I would do it all over again, and I'd do it hopefully better, but I would do it the same way, you know?
Huh, so I'm curious, like, has any of this stuff that has come out, you know, about traumatic, repetitive brain injury, how have you processed that as a former player?
I mean, I definitely think it's something that people should take seriously. Like, I mean, but I'm trying to remember, there was a situation, God, I don't know if it was an NFL player or something, and he suffered a concussion, and, you know, I think there was some debate about it as to when he would be able to come back, and then they said, oh, well, you know, it's just a concussion. He should be able to come back with, you know, within a couple of weeks or so, but he wasn't recovering at the rate that people expect. And so I think, you know, given what we know now about, you know, the results of, like, these repetitive head injuries, like, it's important that people talk about them. But, I mean, there's a couple of things. One, I mean, I was listening to the Sports Guy podcast on ESPN, and, you know, it just kind of hit me to the fact that, you know, people say, oh, well, I wouldn't let my kid play football. But there's not, you know, soccer, for instance, people say, well, I'll let my kid play soccer. Well, you know, soccer is a sport, you know, that has, you know, they've tested people and found they have, the players have concussions at roughly the same rate.
Well, so when you look at the headers and the sort of, like, the goalies running out and the collisions that happen on the field, you have concussions at the same rate. You don't have the constant, like, it's not like soccer players are the same as offensive linemen. You don't have the constant repeated hits, but they're concussed at the same rate.
Well, similar to the idea that maybe you take out headers for people of a certain age, like maybe you don't start letting kids headbutt or use headers in soccer until, you know, they're sufficiently old. So, I mean, just to, we should get some background here. So the science that's been kind of come out over the last 2 years has basically stated that it's not the big hits that cause concussions, that we typically think of like a player getting just like creamed in the middle of, you know, going over the middle to catch a pass and having a concussion. It's actually the hundreds, in some cases thousands, of little hits that kind of undergird the bigger hits that then make concussions possible.
Well, it's that make concussions, and then the other repeated hits are the ones that cause the CTE, which I'm going to have to look up to make sure that I don't say the wrong term, but which is the sort of the disease that results in the like fatty plaques and things like that that you get in the brain that make you have this sort of that affect your mood or make you depressed or make you, like in the case that that Chris Nowinski cited, like that makes somebody like Chris Benoit go basically nuts and kill his entire family. Like there's in my mind there's sort of two separate issues. There's the concussion issue, which is not in any way unique to football. It happens across the board at different rates in almost every sport that you're going to play where you have to come anywhere remotely near another human being. But there's also this bigger problem that is more common in football of CTE, which is the sort of repeated concussion syndrome. Hold on, I'm going to find out what that is. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But that's sort of close. That's a disease that results from, or not the disease, I don't know what the technical that you would actually call it, but that's the problem that you get with those repeated hits to the head and sort of what happens to your brain because of that, which is closely to concussions, but it's not, like, they're two, I think that they're related, but they're not necessarily the same thing. So, like GD mentioned, I love football, and I find that, like, I reflexively want to defend it, and then I start to question myself, like, am I defending it just because I like it? And I think that Nowitzki sort of nails a really good point where he says, listen, the people who are playing this game as adults, like, so long as they go into it with the full knowledge, some people, like you said, Joe, you do it all over again if you have the chance. Like, as long as you go into it knowing as much as you possibly can, we let adults do really dangerous things that people might consider stupid all the time. Like, we still let people box. We still let people play hockey. We still let people be firemen. We let them do all sorts of things that are really dangerous, some of which are arguably more dangerous than playing football.
Right? I guess, you know, the fireman analogy is that, like, that's actually, you know, it's a public.
Right, so fireman is probably not the best way to go. But, I mean, like, we still let people box. And that's possibly even more dangerous. I think that as long as people are going into it knowing exactly what might happen, like, that's your decision as an adult to make. The thing that I think bothers me now, the more that I think about it as I sort of delved into it a little bit, is that, first of all, like, we still don't have a really good idea of, like, of how often this happens or how much it happens to anyone other than professional athletes.
Right, and I think what's really important, though, even though we're not hearing, you know, you use the NFL players kind of to get on, you know, it's permission to start the conversation about how we're treating kids and, you know, making sure that they get the protection that you need. Because, I mean, even as far back, I mean, I'm going to sound like a really old man or something, but I mean, you know, I played football in a time when they said, oh, you got dinged. You know, like, that was a concussion. I mean, really, that was a concussion, but they'd be like, oh, you got dinged. You'll be all right. You know, sit out a couple plays or maybe not even that. You know, I mean, you know, so at least now, you know, maybe we're working towards an admission that, like, these things happen. They're really important to treat them in the way. And it's not a sign of weakness if a guy, you know, has to sit out for a couple of weeks because he suffers a brain injury, you know. But I mean, we didn't think of it in terms of a brain injury, you know, even 15 years ago. We just thought of it as like somebody, oh, he just, you know, it was just a little you got, you know, got his bell rung a little bit, but he'll be okay.
Right, absolutely. It's always kind of taken as a given that you're going to get knocked loopy in football.
All right, yeah, I mean, so, yeah, we've been saying this, but then I think, you know, Monica, you said something interesting before the conversation. You said that you passionately hate football, that you weren't dispassionate at all. What is that out of the same,
because Nicole was like, oh, I'm interested to hear what Monica thinks is like a non-fan and a dispassionate observer. And it's like, no, actually, I really hate football.
Yeah, apparently I just had passion in the wrong way.
So I really hate football because, like, so I grew up in, everybody knows, because I feel like I talk about Arkansas.
Like, back in St. Olaf.
So I grew up in this like super tiny town in football country, and you know where I grew up is like really poor, and everybody's really poor, and you know the schools are really poor and underfunded, and like there's just this outsized importance placed on football, and like there are more coaches than there are science teachers, and we spent 1 year $10,000 on lights that you can see through the whole goddamn town for the football field.
Yeah.
And we never play in the dark, and like the pressure on boys in high school to play football is really intense. Like, I can't, you know, we can talk about peer pressure and how kids shouldn't conform to these ideals, but they do. And that's like, I haven't read Friday Night Lights, but I met Buzz Bissinger once and I've read his other work. And like, what I know about Friday Night Lights, it's like somewhat similar to actually an anthropological work that was released at about the same time called Learning Capitalist Culture. But it's like, but actually that's sort of like what football does. It like, it actually like reinforces power roles in small towns in the South. And so like, you know, people who were quote unquote good at football were like the doctor's sons and the, you know, they were like the car dealership sons, you know, like they weren't actually really good at football. It was just like, these were just the kids who were sort of like going to be the stars anyway, because everything was like a raid in town to make them their stars. So that's where my deep-seated hatred from football comes from. Like, it just got this like ridiculously high level of attention for a town that was like too small and too poor and too bad at football to really get that much attention. Like, we never won a game. We had a 0-20 record for 2 years.
That's pretty sorry.
I mean, we like sucked. We sucked, and we paid the football coaches so much money. And those football coaches also were our science teachers.
Okay, so there's a bunch of questions I have to ask now. Okay, so. No. I mean, okay. So, I actually just finished reading Friday Night Lights last week. It's actually Joel, which is one of Joel's favorite books. And he recommended it to me, and it actually is a fantastic book. For those of you who don't know, Friday Night Lights is Buzz Bissinger, who was a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily Inquirer, left and moved down to this tiny town in Texas called Odessa. That is football obsessed.
But Odessa's not tiny.
Was. I'm sorry. I'm talking as a dirty Northeasterner. So
yeah, I mean, it's like the size of like a. I mean, do you think as many people live on a block in Brooklyn as they do in Odessa, though? I think Odessa has like 100,000 people, maybe 100,000 people. But if it's like the Odessa Midland Metroplex, they've got about 200,000 people total.
Wow, that's not a lot of motherfuckers at all.
That's a city, though. Those
are cities. A big city in the West Texas, by the way.
Yeah,
okay, fair enough. Fair enough. So but Bissinger goes to West Texas. He follows his team around for a year, and he finds out that this city is economically depressed, like the way Monica described the hometown, and that the city is also kind of has very misplaced priority, besides the fact that it's a crazy racist place where everybody says nigga every 5 seconds. but one of the questions I want to ask you, Joel, just piggybacking off of what Monica said, was that like considering like you made the whole free choice argument about like, you know, you that people don't that people no one's making you go play football, but it seems very much like in certain places there's tremendous pressure to play football, right? I mean, so like down the road the injuries that you accumulate are kind of not just these are not injuries that you're getting because you like made an informed choice. I mean, so in the book there's one very minor aside about one of the characters who broke his leg playing football, I think in the 8th grade, his right leg, and so he had to have a plate put on his leg, and then because of that, because his leg was not going to grow because it played on it, he had to have surgery on his left leg to keep his left leg from growing so he didn't have two legs of different sizes. But he was also in the 8th grade, and so like, yeah, he may be making this decision, and he was like torn up about the fact that he couldn't play football anymore, but he was 13 years old, and it seemed like that's a pretty major deal to be like kind of literally like locked into your height at whatever you are at 13 because you've accumulated the kind of injuries that come along with football.
The one thing I guess for people who've never been to Odessa, because amazingly enough I've been to Odessa and Midland.
Oof.
I spent some time there. Yeah, and
Some of us like to go and visit Real America every now and then, GPD.
That's right. That was what Real America. what's funny is I went there to write a story about Odessa Permian in Midland Lee.
Wow.
And when I went there to Midland Lee, I actually interviewed Cedric Benson, but that's another story. Wow. But anyway.
I asked you about this afterwards.
Yeah, right. So this was a long time ago, early in my career. But at any rate, I think one thing, and I think Monica kind of talks about that, I think in like a town like Odessa and Midland, like, it means a lot more than it did in a place like Houston. Like, we can't get all of Texas confused, because in Houston, it's not nearly as important as it is in Odessa. But the thing about Odessa and Midland and places like that out there is that, like, they really were on the downside of the oil boom. And so, like, they had nothing else. Like, I mean, if there's one thing that Odessa could be proud of as a city, it was that they had a good football program. I don't think it's like that everywhere else. Now, once you get into that football culture, though, then I think some of the things that you see happen in Odessa Permian are true. I mean, playing through injuries. You know, I sprained an ankle before my senior year of high school. And, like, I mean, I had never given anybody any reason to think that I didn't want to play football, right? Like, I mean, you know, I sprained my ankle in a preseason scrimmage, and, like, I cried. Because I was like, oh, my God, like, I'm going to miss, like, a couple of weeks of the season. And even then, at a very young age, like, I knew I had, like, a finite amount of time to do things. Like, I was like, oh, my God, I only get, like, you know, 11 Fridays in my life to play football, and I'm going to lose a couple of them. So, you know, I injured my ankle, and people were like, oh, you know, Joel's a bitch, you know, he's nursing his ankle. You know, people, they just kind of assumed that, like, you're just going to, like, heal up and you're ready to go. And I could see, especially when it happens with head injuries, how, like, people could really be pressured into playing when they're not ready to play. And even within yourself, there was, I mean, I'm not going to go on about my terrible football career, but it was another football game where I actually, the concussion that I actually, I mean, the one concussion that I know for a fact I suffered, and I played in that game. I don't remember anything about that game really after like the third quarter. But
do
I
do remember the circumstances of the hit. Was there a hit, or was it just like a?
Oh yeah, it was a hit. I saw it on tape. I was on special teams, and that's like the worst, because
a free shot at you. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So a dude just caught me, and I wouldn't even, you know, you could see my feet go parallel with the ground. Like, oh, that's how he caught me. And I got up, and I didn't know where I was. And I ran to the sideline, because, you know, you're like, oh, I'm not gonna let him show that he hurt me. And I went to the sidelines, and I threw up.
Oh God.
Yeah. But it was something within me. I was saying, like, I didn't take that very seriously. I didn't think, like, oh, my God, I might need to sit out for the rest of the game. I was thinking, well, I've got to shake this off so I can get back in for the next series.
Right.
And that isn't, I don't say that, like, in some macho post, but I'm just saying, like, there's kids out there that are playing ball, probably even today, they're like, I just got to get out there. And so I think that's, like, why we need to educate people about these things, and why it's got to be, you know, something that we talk about, and especially with the NFL talking about going to 18 games and doing all these other things, we really need to talk about, like, the toll that the game takes on people, and not just NFL kids, but, I mean, you know, high school and college kids, too, because, I mean, like I said, they're taking a lot of these blows that, like, people aren't even charting, like, you don't know the extent of the injuries that they're suffering. So anyway, that was a long soliloquy, too. Sorry.
I just want to add to that too, and say that it's not just like the kids thinking that they should do this or whatever, but also, like, a lot of times it's like the parents or the coaches too, like, you know, that idea that this is like, oh, it's just how you learn to be a man, or, like, you know, it's just how you learn to be tough. It's good for you. Like, they, like, sometimes they'll just tell them to play. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know many moms or dads of the football players in my stupid little town who would have said, like, that's all right, son, sit down. You know, yeah, take it easy. Like, I know that didn't happen.
But I wonder how many parents now would, if they knew then what they knew now, if they would have approached it differently. You know what I mean? There's this whole other thing, like, you know, well, that kid's parents or community pushed him to be a football player. And I'm not trying to, because very few players ever end up in the NFL and become successful. But, like, there are people whose families are set for generations, you know, because... because their parents, you know.
That's just a little bit of something else that I wanted to touch on, that they touch on in the podcast, but, and it's been mentioned in a couple of other places, but the general idea is that as it gets or if it becomes more dangerous to play football, or if people realize or get a better, a fuller picture of what the risks are, do you see what's happened, or what some people argue has happened to boxing, happened to football, where it's, you know, where wealthy parents or upper middle class parents are saying, no, you can't play this, it's too dangerous, like, I'm not going to risk it. But for a lower class of kids who that might be their only opportunity to really make it, it becomes really important. So the makeup of people that are playing the game changes. Like now, I would argue, you could go pretty much to any high school in the country with a football team, and if you're the star of that football team, like, it's a big deal. But are we headed towards something where people look down on that? Like, that's just too dangerous. That's, you know, like, there, I don't know how to put this nicely, but, like, there are careers now that people think of as being careers for lower class because it's just too dangerous for me to have to deal with. You know what I mean? And are we looking at that happening to football?
The other kind of part of that, too, is that then it's, like, then those people who, like, are, like, for whom it's, like, okay to play the sport are still going to be entertaining all those, like, middle class people.
I would never guess as to what would happen 30 to 50 years out, like Malcolm Gladwell did, when he says, "Where you don't think people will play football anymore in 30 years or whatever." I have a real hard time envisioning that, like, even like wealthy classes of people will start playing football. Because I mean, you go right back to Texas, and if you look at it, the really good high school teams are in very affluent areas. Like, in fact, one of the best teams in the country for like a 3 or 4 year stretch was in an area of Texas called South Lake Carroll, which is in between Dallas and Fort Worth. And it's like, I mean, really, it's like really one of the wealthiest cities in Texas. I mean, just, very, you know, very white, very few black players that they churn out there. But, I mean, they take football very seriously. And one of the things that they kind of, you know, started up was, like, lining up, you know, getting kids through, like, Pop Warner leagues, elementary, middle school, and high school. They ran the same offense. They had all these kids wear the same uniforms, and they built up a system. Yeah, in fact, their high school coach was one of the rare guys that ended up getting a Division I college football job at one point. He got fired from that job this year, but I mean that's a big deal. So I know what people trying to compare it to boxing, and they're saying, well, you know, it'll be left to lower classes. But I really think there's a lot more built up into football. Like, it's a unique, it's like a really uniquely American sport. And I have like a really tough time imagining that people would just be like, we'll just cede it to the blacks. You know,
right. So that's never happened to anything in American history besides, like, you know, Newark, New Jersey. But like.
But I mean, you don't think, like, as the research comes out, parents are going to be like, no, you can't play that. Like, no, I'm sorry, you just can't. Like, I'm not sacrificing your brain for you to become a football player now. Like,
when has research and stats ever mattered to people, though? I mean, you think about it, though. I mean,
we're just happening on, like, a high school level, I can understand, but, like, I have a really hard time with you telling a parent, like, listen, if you let your kid play football, there's a good chance that this is what their brain could look like in a couple of years, and you're going to be like, all right, you know what, I'm okay with my, like, 6-year-old son playing football. You know what I mean? It's not at the higher levels that it where it bothers me. It's where you get started when you're, like, a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. That's where I think that you would see a drop-off.
So there's a team in, was it Beverly Hills, whatever it is, where Will Smith's son and Joe Montana's son and Wayne Gretzky's sons were all star players.
Thousand Oaks.
Yeah.
Thousand Oaks. Yeah.
These are kids who are exorbitant.
Really?
Yeah. So Will Smith's son was the star receiver. I don't know if he graduated. Was a star receiver. And Joe Montana's son was a star quarterback. I mean, it sounds kind of like a cartoon, right? Like.
It does sound like a
Hanna-Barbera
cartoon.
Absolutely, like, we're the little stars. I'm
little stars. Little stars, that's what it would be called. Every time they high-five, little stars would come out.
Football is the most popular sport in America, and the thing I was trying to tell somebody is, like, it's the most popular sport in America, and it's not even close.
The 30 most watched programs in the country in last year, 28 of them were NFL games.
That's, like, insane, I mean, to me.
That's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how popular football is. That doesn't mean it'll always stay that popular, but it would take a hell of a lot of a blow for it to become, you know, to a point where people stop playing it. I don't know. I don't see that. Maybe they'll change how kids play in Pop Warner, where they'll stop doing drills, where kids are getting hit all the time.
I want to talk about the lockout, but we'll refrain. We'll save that for another time.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things is that the policy decisions that the NFL make will, I mean, this is what everyone keeps saying, and I'm not sure how much I agree with this, but the policy decisions that the NFL makes regarding hitting and regarding concussions the idea is that if the NFL decides to take it seriously, then it will trickle down to college and to high school and to even to Pop Warner.
So here's my question. So there's been all this stuff about, like, designing, we don't know how much is truly concussion-proof, but, like, looking for better helmets and things like that. I have a friend, several friends, who have played rugby, who argue that because there's less padding in rugby, you have to be more cognizant of how you move your body and how hard you hit people and all those sorts of things, so that it's not that they don't get concussions or anything like that, but he makes the argument, and I have no idea whether this is true or not, because I've never played football or rugby, but it's less dangerous because you don't have the padding, so you're not as reckless as you would be when you feel like you're protected. What do you guys think about that?
That's actually a really old argument. I think when they moved to the leather helmets back in the old days, you know, because the NCAA was formed because all these college players were getting killed in, like, I think varsity football. And the White House stepped in, or the federal government stepped in. But that was the argument they made during the leather helmet days, that, like, it was once you started...
But they're making the stuff, but wasn't it Teddy Roosevelt? They were totally made
like,
that
like
up.
I feel like...
He abolished football.
Yeah, he played football, but yeah. I think Joel was right. He abolished it as well.
Oh, he did?
And I think it wasn't until it was, like, regulated in some way that...
Do that, but, yeah.
Yeah, it is crazy.
Do you guys think there's any validity to that argument? Do you think it's true? I mean, I don't know. I have no idea, but...
I mean, it's one of those things that is like hard to quantify, right? I mean, like, how do you measure something like that, right? I mean,
yeah, we don't know what football was like before people started using helmets. Like, the people didn't, you know, monitor those sorts of things then. I don't doubt that sounds plausible, because I mean, that is, you know, you think your helmet gives you, you know, protection, but really what you're doing is ultimately you're using it as a bullet. You know what I mean? You're using it to guide you and hit things, and you feel a lot more secure than you really are inside of a helmet. So it makes sense to me, but I mean, I guess I don't know how you would go about doing that. And I mean, think about, like, what team would be like, you know what, we're going to stop using helmets, and then you have to get, like, all of these other people to start doing.
I think the helmet thing is really interesting because somebody else, because I think there was a story in the Times like 2 weeks ago where somebody was making this argument, because I guess they were, you know, just all this.
Joe Paterno makes this argument, by the way.
That really?
Opa.
Yeah, Joe Pa thinks that either they will or that they should get rid of the helmet.
There you go. He remembers when there were no helmets.
Say that again.
That's cold-blooded.
But it's kind of true. Yeah, but it's kind of true, right? I mean, I guess, maybe? I don't know. Well, we'll see.
I mean, it makes sense.
I mean, but people were... I mean, they went to helmets because people were dumb. I mean, so the problem is, though, it's, like, hard to separate how dangerous the game was back then with the way it was played. It used to be, I'm going to drop back and give my ball to one of my five tailbacks or whatever, and they're going to slam me, you know what I mean? And we're going to slam them into the dirt. Like, that... is going to get people hurt and killed. You know, I mean, that's not the way football is played now.
Right, and then when they played football back then, like, they never envisioned somebody would ever look like Ray Lewis. They would move as fast as, you know,
right?
Like, he would have been an animal.
Absolutely, there's no conception of a dude who's 6'5" or 6'4" and 250 something pounds who runs a 4.5, 4.6.
Bigger, faster, stronger.
Yeah.
It seems like a really compelling argument to me that, like, if you, especially knowing now what we know about the human body and, like, what the hips do to you and how, I mean, like, these are people who make their living on their bodies and they're, like, very, very careful with them. So it seems to me like if the NFL were to say tomorrow, all right, we're not going to have any helmets, you know, we're going to have the bare minimum of padding, like, you immediately have to become more careful about how you hit people. Like, I'm going to hit you just hard enough to put you down, but not hard enough that it causes any serious damage to me, because I want to be able to do this next week, you know?
But there's also the semiotics of something like that, right? I mean, like, the if nothing else, the kind of excessive padding of football gives the appearance of, like, rigor as it pertains to safety, right? Like, I mean,
yeah.
Like, even if you went away from helmets, if you went away from helmets, it would look like barbarism. It would look like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It might not... Okay, so let's take this premise and say that maybe having a helmet makes it more dangerous, so not having a helmet should make it less dangerous. It wouldn't look less dangerous to have. If you had, Adrian Peterson running up the middle and Clay Matthews slamming into him, like, and they were just wearing, Under Armour
shorts.
I know what you're saying, but I'm like wincing just thinking about it. Yeah,
it would just look
no terrible. Way that looks safer.
It would look terrible. Yeah, it would look.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe that's some sort of greater argument about how we ignore the brutality of football or something.
I mean, that's a long conversation right there, right? I mean, we should move on to NPR and the recent firing of one of their executives. He was caught in a trap set by James O'Keefe, or some minions of James O'Keefe, who was famous for being dressing up as a pimp and subsequently actually destroying Acorn, leading to the defunding and destruction of Acorn. I guess he has another head to mount on his wall. Nicole?
So I want to lay out the timeline of this just because what I think happened initially shouldn't have been that much of a controversy. The gotcha video is basically two people from James O'Keefe's outfit. They're sitting down with a guy whose name is Ron Schiller. He's like a senior vice president or senior vice president for development at NPR. Now, when they sat down and like had this meeting, Schiller had already told people at NPR, like had already basically not resigned, but was planning on moving on to another job at the Aspen Institute. And so he got in trouble, first of all, for saying that NPR would be better off without government funding, and we're calling the Tea Party racist.
The people he sat down with dinner with were posing as people from this Muslim group. This like
right, they were posing this, as like, the Muslim Education group. Council or something like that. So the thing that bothers me about this first little bit of it is that I think that the whole furor over NPR and defunding it proves that, like, Ron Schiller got in trouble because the official NPR line is, we need federal funding. The fact that all of this is happening, I think, is pretty good proof that he was right. Like, maybe NPR would be better off without federal funding. They wouldn't have to fight this fight every couple of years or so. Yeah. That being said, as the official fundraiser of NPR, he should have towed the company line, but that's very much an internal matter. Second thing is, I can't really get mad at him for saying in an interview that the Tea Party is racist, because I happen to think that they are, first of all. Second of all, Jack Schaefer had a really good point on Slate where he's like, when you are hunting for money from rich people, like, you tell them what they want to hear. Like, they have crazy ideas, and you smile and nod and get them to write a check and then do whatever with the check. And I think that in the grand scheme of things, this guy basically agreeing with this group that's posing as a Muslim group, that the Tea Party is racist and that there's xenophobic. I don't really have a problem with that. Maybe it's because I'm some sort of left liberal East Coast elitist, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, also that's the way that he gets money, is by like nodding and smiling and having an engaging conversation.
Exactly. Like that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to tell the funders whatever they want to hear.
Yeah, he's not a news executive, which is why this is stupid. He's not supposed to be, like, objective. But I think also what was happening in the video actually proved his point about the Tea Party being racist, because this video was this right-wing group going, NPR gives money to Muslims. Like, that's what it was. Like, they were, like, seriously, it was like, look at him agreeing that Muslims aren't terrible. Like, he's so dumb. Like,
I think I'm of two minds of this. One, I don't disagree with what Schiller said, but that doesn't mean that I think he should have said it. And the only reason I say that is because I think there's a way to, like, raise money without, like, revealing. You know, I mean, we don't even know that he believes it. I mean, we're saying right now that he's just agreeing with people, yada, yada, yada. I do think that there's a way that you can have that conversation and not air yourself out like that, you know? And
And you're still representing an organization. And I mean, I guess maybe I'm just really wary of, like, when I'm out and I'm in my capacity as, you know, for the organization that I work for, I'm really careful. People always are trying to draw me into, like, you know, political conversations, or, you know, that's, you know, what they're saying, or, you know, the Obamacare, or, you know, whatever, you know, which is really strange that people would start trying to, like, see if I'll, like, join in on criticism of, like, Barack Obama. And they know I'm black. What they think of, like, the typical black, you know, young guy that, like, they think I'd be in the tank, but then they'll just, like, start going in. I don't know if they just want me to be, like, I don't know.
I mean, I kind of agree with you, Joel, but I also kind of agree. I feel like there's tension in nonprofits and in any group that has to raise money between, I think, the money people and the programmatic people, because sometimes the money people have to do things that the programmatic people wouldn't necessarily agree with. But if they don't do them, then you don't have money to run a program. And I think that this is a really good illustration of that tension. But
do you think that's the only way? I mean, do you think that what he said, I guess you're saying, do you think what he said cinches the deal? Like, I don't see how, like, what he said, it just seems extra. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I'm having a conversation with somebody that I don't really know, you know, in any walk of life, like, I'm not going to give that much of myself in a conversation with anybody that's a virtual stranger. I think, like, once you get to be a professional,
yeah, but
whatever,
it's
like,
different conversation than the one that you have when you're trying to get somebody to give you. I mean, I think the check was supposed to be for $5 million. Like, when NPR is staring these funding cuts in the face, and somebody's trying to offer me a $5 million check, like, I'm going to vet it, but I'm probably not going to say anything that will piss them off, or you know, or I'm going to try and agree with them as much as, like, I don't think he said anything that was really that awful. You know what I mean? Like, he didn't say the Tea Party are all, like, Nazi sympathizers or something, like, really just terrible. What he said, while some people might be offended by it, I personally think that it's true. Like, I don't think it was that far out of line that he should be so demonized for it. And I definitely don't think it was far enough out of line that it was in any way. I mean, the only part of this I think where NPR should really have an issue is when he didn't stick to the company line about federal funding. Like, that should be their biggest issue. And my opinion. I think the rest of this is just sort of like, you could chop. Like, I feel like this conversation happens so many times, not only for places like NPR, but for conservative, for libertarian, for all kinds of think tanks and organizations, like, all over the city. It happens all the time. He just got videotaped in a gotcha moment doing it. Like, that's the only difference.
Yeah. I'll just say too that, I think he did get a little too much like a personable person. Like, he was just talking as a person and maybe sort of forgot about his NPR role or whatever. But also, it's like, being personable is still his job. Like, it's his job to, like, be personable and get people to like him or whatever. But I think that also this speaks to, like, a larger issue about how terribly NPR deals with these things. Like, you know, they just, like, fire everybody. I don't think there's anybody left to fire over there. And, like, the problem I have with it is that sort of, like, reinforces the idea that they were doing something wrong. And, like, this, right, I do understand that. Yeah, I understand the NPR position. They are in a position. They do want to be taken as a credible news source. And they do accept federal funding. And so they do have to be fair. I do understand that they are walking a really, really fine line. But I think this, like, sort of, like, off with their heads attitude they have every time some story like this breaks needs to stop, because it's ridiculous.
That's the other thing I wanted to touch on, is that they then fired Vivian Schiller, who is the CEO of NPR, who is not in any way related to him. Like, she got fired today. She was also under some fire for firing Juan Williams. And, like, that sort of became an issue. And I can't remember the name of the woman who got fired then, but it was sort of seen as, like, her being the scapegoat. And I guess having these two things happen under her watch, it was time for her to go. But I just, it seems so completely ridiculous, you know?
Right. Well, I'm going to always argue against people getting fired. Like, I didn't think Juan Williams should have gotten fired. Like, I didn't think Rick Sanchez should have gotten fired. You know, I'm generally a person who's like, look, you know, especially if you screw up and it's your first time, like, your first time offending, I'm more in, like, the camp of, like, you know, stand behind your employee unless it's something that's so unconscionable, you know, that you can't stand behind them. But
again, I think there's a difference between being personable.
I mean, he did call the Tea Party racist.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
I'm kidding.
Have you ever? I guess you guys have heard of the term, like, you're just too familiar. Like, you've been in a conversation with somebody, and like you're kind of familiar, though.
Yeah.
Like, you all know each other, like.
Y'all are so country. I just y'all are some country motherfuckers.
That's country.
Yeah, that's some pretty country shit.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, yeah, man, it's just like you're a little too familiar. You know what I'm saying? And I just kind of feel like, you know, and maybe this is just, you know, like, yeah, the southerner coming out of me or whatever. But I'm just kind of like, you know, like, look, man, you can have those conversations, but sometimes it's best not to have them with people you don't know. And I think there's a way to have that conversation with that guy and to agree with him, this fake Muslim dude who he got set up with, and not air yourself out. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, I agree that I think, you know, NPR didn't have to, like, kowtow like this. I think they do have to, like, address it and say, hey, look, that's not anything that we sanction, or we, you know, as an organization. I mean, we don't, you know, we're committed to fairness, yada yada yada. But I do think, though, that the guy kind of opened himself up to that criticism. I think it's fair. I don't think you should fire them just because Fox gets pissed. But I do think that you have to kind of get, you know, let your employees know that, like, hey, look, you're always representing us. You're always representing us, and you should, you know, be careful with that. So I don't know. Yeah, but that's me. I'm old and I'm stayed like that. So
I mean, I agree with that. Always representing, like, that you're always representing your employee, I guess. But how far do you take that? You know what I mean? Like, if you're always representing your employer, like that.
Oh, but this guy was actually representing NPR in that capacity, though.
Right.
At that,
like,
it wasn't like he invited him over for, like, a wine, for some of the wines he was talking about.
That would be he'd be a bad host, because Muslims can't drink.
Yeah, right.
So if he invited them over for a halal dinner. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, yeah, right.
He invited them over for tea. How about that?
Right,
Everyone can have tea,
yeah, absolutely.
There you go.
I actually wanted to go back to the point that Nicole was making about whether or not NPR should continue to be so reliant on public funding. I mean, how much of NPR's budget comes from private donations versus government funding?
Less than 10% of their funding comes from the federal government. That being said, it's still a hefty chunk of money that they would have, like, issue replacing if it went away tomorrow.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, but the vast majority of their money comes from private donors.
I mean, I like the idea of NPR getting federal funding because it is national public radio. And while some people will say that it's nothing but some super left-wing outlet like, you know, the New York Times or the Washington Post or every paper that's not the Wall Street Journal, I think that there's some inherent, I guess, social good in having what is sort of like a national, sort of even-handed news organization. Like, a lot of times I feel like, God, I'm starting to sound like a parody of myself, but a lot of times I feel like NPR is the source I know that I can trust. Like, I know that there's not going to be a whole lot of spin on it. Like, they're going to do as good of a job as any human being can, or any organization run by human beings can, of trying to provide an objective viewpoint. And I really value that. And I think that there's some value in an organization like that getting money and support from the federal government, even if it's only a nominal amount. That being said, looking at it from a purely financial standpoint, I think NPR is way better off without federal funding, because then they don't have to worry about this.
One of the things is, I remember, and I can't remember where I read the study, but that NPR's audience, the main consistency among its audience isn't, like, ideology so much as it is, like, education and income. Like, NPR's audience is more educated and makes a little bit more money than, like, the rest of the population. But there's a pretty big chunk of conservatives who has one of their primary news sources. I mean, so it's weird that it's still – that it carries this weird taint of like, being a lefty organization. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I also, like, just another – point about the value of having federal funding too. NPR is in places that other news or gathering organizations that rely just entirely on profit or whatever would have long ago abandoned. You know, there's like an NPR outpost in you know, on Alaska, like the chain of islands off the coast of Alaska, there are reporters, and that's really valuable to the whole country. Like, it's really valuable that we get news from there when it happens.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're one of the few organizations, I think, that has sort of maintained an international bureau and maintain, like you said, outposts, like all of, not just like syndicated news, but like actually have reporters on the ground all over the place.
The interview read Farhad Manjoo's takedown of NPR readers, NPR listeners. He was saying that.
I feel like maybe I did, but
the name, the headline of the article was, I listen to NPR, so I don't have to hear this nonsense. That was the article. It was basically like.
Yeah, that is what they always say.
Exactly. That's always how it is. It's like, you know, somebody complaining about, you know, somebody shouting out, you know, Trick Daddy or something on NPR. It's like, I listen to Trick Daddy. What?
I listen to NPR. NPR precisely to avoid this sort of stupidity. That's what it's called.
It's always like, I'm not gonna lie, more from NPR.
I mean, every now and then I wake up and hear, like when Jay Smooth was doing those like culture music segments. I like woke up one morning and Nicki Minaj was on my radio, and I was like, "What?"
You were like, "I listen to NPR specifically to avoid this kind of stupidity."
I don't even like. I haven't changed the radio station on my radio, my alarm clock, in like years, so I have no idea what's going on right now.
Right. Absolutely.
Wow. Really. I you know what? It wasn't until maybe 2 years ago that I ever listened to NPR. Like, I don't. I am not. I don't know what it is. But I have just completely. I tried it for like a couple of weeks, and then I just would be like, "Meh." I start listening to like again. I just can't do it. I tried. Like, I feel like ignorant for like admitting that.
No.
I just cannot. I just can't do it, man. And I only have so much radio time in the car, and I gotta get all my music in.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I think you and I are two opposite ends of the extreme, Joel, because I feel like every week I find some really like random esoteric program on some bizarre NPR affiliate in like middle of nowhere Alaska, and I'm like, oh my god, this is so amazing. How come I didn't know this is going on? And then I'm like, nobody's listening to me and like three other people. That's it.
Grand Theft Auto 4, they had a fake NPR station that you could listen to in the cars, and it was like lulling you to sleep with liberal soft pedaling. Little tagline, and it was really funny.
Oh my gosh, that's funny. I mean, you know, I don't know what else to say at this point. I mean, I actually love NPR. I mean, especially This American Life has been on a roll this year. Like, I mean, they've been
that's PRI.
Oh, well, never mind then.
Oh.
I take it all back. Fuck you, NPR.
I mean, it's on an NPR station. I don't know entirely how it works. Like, NPR's weird. It's like the affiliate stations pay to get NPR programs.
Yeah, there's like PRI, NPR, and something else, some other like American public media. I'm like, make up your damn mind. I remember, so just as an aside, LaToya Peterson, who is a friend of mine, but who runs the blog Rage Delicious, we were meeting up for lunch one day, and she was actually sitting in guest hosting the Michael Eric Dyson show. And she's like, you know, it was like, I know it's a public radio show, so we're supposed to meet up. And I like was rushing to meet her. Cause she was, and I was like, oh, I'm here at the building. She's like, what building? Like the NPR building. She's like, no, I'm not at the NPR building. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? And she was like, I'm at the down the street on American Public Radio. I was like, what the hell is that? I'm like, man, this is the RC Cola of public radio. I was mad. I was angry as hell. Like, I'm at the wrong place right now.
RC Cola is sort of delicious. It got the short shrift.
Before we start talking about NPR ephemera and start judging Joel for listening to Wiz Khalifa really mad bat loudly on Peachtree Avenue as he drives through Atlanta. We should go to shout outs. Joel, do you want to start actually?
Yeah, I guess so. That's fine. There's you know, I always come with like two or three things, right? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
But no, I'm only gonna go with two this time. One, the other day when I was on Twitter, somebody retweeted a link of these pictures of like Egypt in the 1920s. And it was like incredible. And the website is called howtobearetronaut.com. And it has like a lot of pictures, a lot of posters, things from like, you know, different decades. a lot of 20s stuff, a lot of stuff from the 40s. Like even here right now, they've got pictures of like Ireland from the 1920s. And the reason this is really cool to me, and I mentioned this on Twitter one time, was that it wasn't until I was about 9 or 10 years old that I realized that like life in like the 50s and 40s and 30s was like in color, like that it happened in color. Because, you watched TV shows as a kid. Like everything was like black and white.
I used to think the same thing. You're not alone. I used to think the same thing.
Yeah, I'm an idiot. I thought World War II, Jack Johnson fight. You know, like everything was like 1970.
I used to think the same thing, and I was like, "Mom, what was life like when it was in black and white?" She was like, "What?"
Right, it's nuts. And so like it's just interesting to see these pictures from like the 1920s with like so much vivid color and like, you know, Egypt. And I mean, obviously there's the morbid part of me that's like, everybody I'm looking at in these pictures, like there's colors, but like all these people are dead now. I don't know why I thought that, but at any rate.
Thanks for sharing your morbid thigh, Joel.
Yeah, no, right, I can't help myself. I'm sorry, I have to like kind of offset, you know, the NPR thing, but so there's more depth to me than that. It was like football, like NPR.
Joel was like, after this podcast, I'm gonna eat some meat. You know what I mean? Just a bowl of meat.
Just gonna go punch somebody on the street for no reason.
Absolutely. You know?
It's like out of my face. But this website is really cool. So, I mean, if you're, like, into stuff like that and you were, like, you know, a child, if you haven't been disabused of the notion that, like, the 1930s happened in, like, real, live, vivid colors, like, you should go to that website. And the other thing was we subscribed to Netflix. And the other night, my wife ordered Magnolia for me, which is Magnolia is probably my favorite movie.
Really? The Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
Worship,
man.
The Cock movie, that one?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. PTS, it is Friday, man. It is my shit. Like, I will watch that all the time. I haven't watched it in so long. I was always joking with my wife, is that I would never marry anybody who refused to watch Magnolia with me. So,
I've actually never seen it.
Oh, really? Oh, man. It's awesome. I mean, it's kind of weird. But it's got like, you know, Tom Cruise. I mean, actually, it's like Tom Cruise. It's like the Tom Cruise that people think of today. Like this, that role that he's in, like you kind of see the hints of it in the Worship the Cock guy. And Julianne Moore, John Reilly, Jason Robards, like one of his final roles before he died. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
That is a bananas cast. That cast is bananas.
It's nuts. It's a little over 3 hours. I can't recommend it enough, and it's just kind of like all these different threads and about like how like all these things kind of relate together. Like you're just I can't even really do it justice by describing it. All I can do is say go watch it. It's a great movie. So anyway,
what is your wife Melinda think about this, about the movie?
Oh no, it came in the other night, so we're gonna watch it this weekend.
Like, oh okay,
like, it came in last night, and I was like, all right, let's go ahead and sit down and watch it. She's like, no, I'm gonna watch it on the weekend. I was like, okay, but. Same thing that happened with Moral Spittles. Like, it's another one of my favorite movies. It's got subtitles.
What's this?
I think Amores Perros.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The guy that did 21 Grams, which is a great movie. And
21 Grams is a good movie.
Yeah, I love 21 Grams. It's a really morbid. I like really morbid, like, sad movies. Like, I can't go to the movies and, like, watch, you know, buddy cop shit. You know, we went and watched the Adjustment Bureau on Saturday, and like I just wanted it to be like a horrible. Like I was like, it didn't end more negatively. I'm sorry. So anyway, but don't go see Adjustment Bureau, by the way.
Oh man.
So, anyway, so those are that's my list.
So okay, so that's
it's like raining here now. I'm all depressed.
Yeah,
I know, right? Exactly. Thank you, Joel.
Yeah, go throw in Magnolia and check it out.
So okay, it was How to Be a Retronaut, Magnolia, and don't see the Adjustment Bureau, right?
Just to
I'm gonna try to get at Magnolia this weekend, actually.
Yeah, you should. It's an awesome movie, really. It is.
It's funny you should mention movies because I actually do have a movie shout out. But I'll get to that. So I actually wanted to shout out a post that we highlighted on the blog earlier from LaToya on about being sort of like the token being the token on feminist panels and on like speaking panels and things like that. And not only do I recommend that you read the post, but I recommend that you like click through all of the links there, because there are a lot of them. But it just, I don't know why it like really, I feel like an, oh wait, I can't, I'm trying not to curse for Lent, so I feel like a butthole when I say this, but like the piece really spoke to me, and I just thought it was really, really interesting and really well written. And it's one of those things that you read and all of a sudden like you start thinking about things differently. And it just, it's really good, and I can't recommend it highly enough. So I wanted to sort of re-highlight that.
It's a really good post. Actually, we should probably see if we can have Latoya on the next time to talk about it a little bit more at length.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a great post. Yeah.
And then the other thing that I wanted to highlight is I have the taste in movies of a 14-year-old boy, so I will pretty much see any movie that has a really good car chase or animatronic dinosaurs in it. And this weekend, I watched both The Lost World, Jurassic Park 2, and Jurassic Park 3.
Jurassic Park 3 is terrible. Sorry.
I don't disagree with that, but like...
Which one was the one where the dinosaur ran crazy in L.A.?
It wasn't LA, it was San Diego, and that was the second one.
Oh, that was terrible. Sorry, that was the one that was terrible.
That's so absurd. I'm sure I watched those, but I don't remember that.
It says, Sonic and Clover, anytime I own them both.
Let me know when that's happening, because I'm going to be there for that. That shit was... I was in the movie, and I was like 15 or 16. Like I was amped to see that. I was like, this is some bullshit.
The original Jurassic Park in the theater, and like my most salient memory from it, because it was a terrifying, the original one was terrifying.
Yeah, it was,
and so I was like, what, how old were we, like 12 or something?
Yeah, we're young. Damn, we just ate ourselves.
That young, really?
Yeah. Oh.
Never mind, I feel better now.
I was in the back watching the movie, and like when the first dinosaur came out, this like 4-year-old that somebody had brought to the theater just started screaming and ran up the aisle and like screaming, going like, ah! And then, like, the mom comes after. It's like, I don't know what they thought. Like, if it was, they didn't care. If they thought it was, like, a movie about pretty dinosaurs. You know? But it was pretty funny.
You also got to consider that, like, Monica probably saw this, like, a year and a half after the rest of us because she lived in the sticks.
That's
true. So it's fine. At her theater, it's like 1995. She's like, I heard this movie called Big.
No, actually, we had to go to it's not like we had to wait. We just had to go to a town that was, like, an hour away.
You know what's interesting about all, I've never seen Jurassic Park.
What?
Yeah. No, never.
Joel.
Wow.
Added to the list of things that I've never seen that's shocking. Star Wars. Never seen any Star Wars movie.
I'm gonna say right now, you Star Wars is the most overrated shit in the world.
Yeah, okay. I don't care about Star Wars, but I am deeply disturbed that you have not seen Jurassic Park.
Man.
Also, because I don't know how you avoided it.
You can't get me to. I was in high school then. I didn't have to go anywhere.
Damn.
I wanted.
Damn, but you're only like 3 years older than us, right? I mean, I guess it makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. I read the book. I had to read the book for class.
I read both of the books. The book Congo. Have you guys ever read that one?
Yes, I had to read that. That was summer reading.
Deeply disturbing. I got really disturbed.
Congo, with like the one that ended up becoming a movie.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't watch the movie because the book was so disturbing.
It was written by Michael Crichton too.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Same author.
Michael Crichton, just as an aside, was 6'10". Every time I saw him on TV, I'm like, yo, you should be a power forward somewhere. You know what I mean?
Like you're Montel Jordan. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're front line. Doing this wrong. You're doing this all wrong. You know what I mean? You're spending all this time writing these books. You're getting that loot. You know what I mean?
No, I was gonna say those are the two I watched both of those movies this weekend, and I enjoyed them way more than anyone should have.
Oh my gosh.
I do have a shout down though, because I think Monica will appreciate this.
Is that the theme? Two shout outs and a shout down?
Well, I just read about it today and it really made me sad. So speaking of RC Cola, my favorite show ever. Is going national, which makes me really sad because you used to only be able to find it in like the Carolinas and a little bit of Georgia and a little bit of Virginia, and it was like a treasure hunt. And every time I
Cheerwine. Do you remember this conversation? A couple podcasts ago, all the Southerners, and I refer to you as Southerner too, Jewel, but all the
everyone but you.
Yeah, basically, it was Nicole, Jamel, and Monica were singing the praises of this stuff called Cheerwine, when I was growing up, we just called it sperm killers, because, I mean, you know, so the 50-cent soda you get from the corner store that, like, it's like... It's so sweet that it scorches the back of your throat. That's what that sounds like.
I don't want you to denigrate cheer wine like that. I am offended.
I only ever had it when I tasted it in the form of Nicole's cake, which is really delicious.
That sounds vile.
I might have eaten the whole thing in an alarmingly short amount of time.
I mean, it is a pretty good cake.
So it's going national. So, but now we'll be able to partake, though. I want to see what
the fun. I feel like it's not going to taste as good now. Part of the fun was that I couldn't get it whenever I wanted
that
it.
That is,
I would, like, have to sit here and
the most
it.
Hipster shit I've ever heard in my life. Yo, I was up on that cheer wine, son, before y'all was, you know what I mean, before it sold out. Before it went crossover. Like, what's wrong?
Sorry, I can't help it. That's just the way I feel. I'm sad. I mean, I'm still going to be really excited that I could go to the store and buy it, but yeah.
I gave up sugar for Lent, but when that comes up, when that happens in D.C., me and you are going to have some cheer wine.
I have cheer wine in my refrigerator right now, and I was really excited because my uncle, like, brought it from North Carolina for me, and then, like, today I'm like, oh, cheer wine's going national. That's lame.
That is so...
They're trying to get money. That's crazy, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But... this era of globalization, cheer wine needs to be international. They need to have, you know...
Yeah, that's how we felt when Blue Bell ice cream went national, you know? But then you get over it, and you're like, well, shit, I can get good ice cream.
Exactly. Monica, do you have two shout-outs and a shout-down, since that's the thing?
Two shout-outs. So, I write for a magazine, and the shout-out is from it. So we have every month, we have a parody. And they're not, it's like a little funny thing. And it's not always hilarious, I will say. But this month it actually turns out to be really funny and actually really prescient because we did it on like other pimp and hoe undercover busts that James O'Keefe could do. Like we gave him like a potential one. And so he did like a bust of Costco and a bust of like Archer Daniel Midland Company, and it's like from the theme of that movie Informant, and it's like a bust of ASPCA, and it's like pimp goes to animal shelter with ho, says ho is like the cat, animal shelter gives her a cat. like all the, you know, the things that they uncover, whatever. It's actually pretty funny, and I can post the link online. And then the other thing I wanted to shout out is I'm reading a book now called George Washington's First War by David Clary, who's a historian. And I really love, I mean, all I read is nonfiction, and I have like I'm trying to read books about every single president. But like, so this is actually really interesting because it's about George Washington's early life and sort of like the frontier battles that he was conscripted into doing before he was a war general in the Revolution. And it's actually really engagingly written. Like normally historians can be a little bit dry and hard to read. So this guy's actually a really good writer. So I'm going to just shout that out.
No, this is crazy that you guys, we can go ahead and do your thing, Judy, because you guys read, and it's just amazing. Like, I just don't, the books, you all like are reading books like all the damn time. Like, it really, really make me feel embarrassed.
Don't feel bad, Joel. I had a goal to read a book a week this year, and so far I've managed to make it through The New Yorker and read one book.
Yeah, that was my goal, too. I'm a book number 5. I need to be at, like, book number 10 or something like that. I'm waiting on.
The past few books I've had to read have been for work, and so it's really nice to read for fun again.
Yeah. I actually wanted to shout out, a couple of weeks ago, Nicole posted a link to this this public radio project called Back of the Bus, and it was about the way transit policy, the way race has informed transit policy, and the way transit policy has actually been an instrument of race, like of institutional racism, how it's like cut out certain communities, how in the role that public transportation has played in gentrification of cities, and looked at Oakland and DC and Atlanta actually, and I was actually wanted Joel to listen to it because I was curious to what he thought would think about because there's a lot of people boo-hooing Atlanta's terrible public transit,
which is crazy. It's crazy. That's crazy, by the way. Why people say that? Because it's it has the best public transit of any city I've ever lived in.
Damn, really?
Well, let's think about where you've lived.
Okay,
No, look, I lived in Houston, which is theoretically the fourth largest city in the country, right? I lived in Dallas, which is number 7, with Fort Worth and Dallas. I mean, I was there for 7 and a half years. I lived in Oklahoma. I lived in Louisiana.
I lived in Tampa, which has a horrible public transit system. In Atlanta, would we actually have, like, you know, a train stop, like, a block away from where I live? Like, it's incredible. Like, we went to a Hawks game. I used it when we went to a Hawks game a couple weeks ago. That's it, though. I have not, you know. Not, well, I'm used to have a car.
Right, exactly.
Therein lies the problem.
So, actually, one of the things they were talking about was how there was this neighborhood at the end of, at right past the end of the train line that was kind of disenfranchised. Like, once you got to the end of it, that neighborhood is completely economically impoverished because there's no way to get around. And, you know, and how the way that the public transportation in Atlanta is set up keeps the city from having a strong center city. You know what I mean? Everybody drives, and so there's, like, no... it's weird to me because, again, I'm a dirty Northeast city boy, so, like, I've been on buses and subways by myself since I was in the fourth grade, and so, like, I don't know how to drive, so, you know, whatever. But, like, it was really fascinating, and there was this brief little aside, you know, on the way public policy, again, on the way public policy kind of becomes an instrument of racism. And Monica and I bring this up all the time, but Robert Moses, like, jammed the Cross Bronx Expressway through the South Bronx when it was, like, a thriving working/lower middle class neighborhood for a long time. And that's, like, what created the South Bronx is now the poorest congressional district in the country.
I was going to say, but the reason nobody drives is that it's always more of a pain in the ass to drive than it is to take public transit, which is, like, what cities have to get to. If cities want mass transit, they have to get to a point where it's always more of a pain in the ass to drive.
Right, it's always going to be easier for Joel to drive in Atlanta than it is going to, you know what I mean, than it's going to be for him to take the train.
Yeah, because even if I wanted, because, like, right now gas is, what, you know, $3.50. We're basically roughly $3.50 a gallon. If I could get to work and know that I could get back and it wouldn't be a hassle, like, I would do that, you know, every day, you know, if I could. But it's just not possible right now. But I at least like to have the option for those times when it might be, you know, that much more difficult. But yeah, that's interesting. But yeah, you don't know how to drive. That's crazy.
It's one of those things, like, I never feel like an adult, like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, like, no matter what happens, like, I'm gonna have kids, or I'm gonna have, you know, like...
God, we don't have to get into that. They're in trouble. That's all I'll say.
Man. I can't think of another thing to shout out and another thing to shout down, so, I'm gonna leave it there. On behalf of Joel and Nicole and Monica, we will see you in 2 weeks. Be easy.
Our theme music is 8 by Aaron, and this podcast was produced by GD. Check us out at postbougie.com.
Done.
Lulling you to sleep with liberal soft pedaling.